Welcome to Stand to Reason, friends. That's the name of the show. I'm Greg Kokel, your host, and have been for just breaking out on 32 years now. That is hard to imagine when I think about it. In 1990, I think it was February 10th or 11th, something like that, that's when I started as a broadcaster at the flagship station KBRT with the Crawford Broadcasting Network, and I'm very thankful for them giving me a test. Many of you know, because I've mentioned it in the past, that I had never had any ambitions of being in radio. It wasn't like it really tickled my fancy at the time. My first couple years actually were really difficult because I didn't know what I was doing. But I found a niche, and God has prospered that. How can I say this? Even after 32 years, it isn't like I'm think, wow, this is like a joyride for me. I think it's like driving. You know, when you first start to drive, you think, whoa, everything's new, and you're doing the deal. And my daughter's working on getting her permit now. And so, yeah, that's kind of cool. But after a while, it becomes automatic, not exactly mechanical, but very much so in some ways. And so this is true with a lot of things in life. I do radio not because it's I like kind of like radio road trips type thing, but because I like making a difference. And this is an opportunity God has given me to make a difference. And from the feedback I've gotten, that's been happening. And that I am thankful for, and I don't take it for granted. It is an example of what I've said many times to encourage people in their ambitions of moving forward for the kingdom's sake, to bloom where you're planted. That is, do what you can where you're at. And I remember receiving an invitation in late 1989 to test for a radio program. I thought, oh, well, why not? Give it a shot. We'll see. It might work. It might make a difference. And that's why I did it. And so in blooming at that spot, that gave me more opportunities. It's blossomed into a big thing and has opened other doors as well. But this, the basic principle is bloom where you're planted. So I am glad to be here with you for that reason, to be of service to you as a follower of Christ. If you're not a follower of Christ, I hope I annoy you a little bit in a good way, as I often say, by putting a stone in your shoe. And we get questions in that from folks like that too, and challenges from folks like that as well. So I'm glad for both. I want to answer a question before I get to the other callers. We have three in the queue at the moment. That was raised that last week, I think it was Sunday, that a week ago Sunday, that was raised in a Meet the Teacher special event online for those who had completed some of the requisite number of courses for Stand to Reason University. I'm chuckling because I can't remember what that is. Maybe it's three or four courses. And incidentally, I think we have 9 courses there at STRU now. And just this last month, or maybe this month, we released 2 new courses. I did one of them on atheism. I call it Bumping into Reality. And John Noyes did another on the problem of evil. And those are available. And just saying, but those who are part of this event had taken a number of classes already, qualifying them to be part of this kind of online meet and greet. I talked a bit about some things and then I answered questions, but I didn't answer them all. Pardon me. And one of the questions is one I think is relevant here. It came up tangentially in the last hour. And that question is, what is truth? Is truth knowable? Or do we only have a strong hunch, if you will, or maybe a confidence, or maybe do we have a certainty? So this is all part of the question, okay? And this is why I think it's important as a tutorial to make clear what we mean by the word itself, all right? The word truth is a word that describes a relationship. And here, now I'm going to get philosophical, but it won't be difficult. It will be precise. And that, to me, is part of the value of philosophy. It is an enterprise that generates more precision about important things. And I even see some of the callers coming up. Oh, my goodness, I lost one. I'm sorry about that. Oh, that always hurts my heart because I didn't want to talk to you. Maybe, Amy, you can give me a note somewhere there in the studio chat about that question again. And if I get to the end of the show, I can answer it in the caller's absence. But sometimes dealing with these issues that come up require a kind of precision that I wouldn't be able to provide if I hadn't had the training that I did in philosophy under J.P. Moreland and the rest of the crowd over at Talbot. And my M.A. Phil has really served me in good stead there. But this particular issue, truth, is an example of that, but this is not hard. Okay? Truth is a relationship between a claim and the world. Truth is a relationship between a claim and the way the world is. And the claim is about the world. And if the world is the way the claim describes, then the claim is true. All right. When I was talking to Cade last hour, I touched base on that a little bit. And that's why I mentioned then it's so important when we're talking about like Genesis and that whole thing and the science and all that, we can't just dismiss the claims of the scientific community as, well, are you going to listen to God? I'm sorry, are you going to listen to men or are you going to listen to God? I think that's a false characterization. We're not just listening to men. What we are looking at is what appear to be well-justified facts about the world that human beings, being made in the image of God, have been able to discover. And so we are trying to take that seriously in light of certain claims the Bible makes. Because if we don't have a matchup, then we can't claim the Bible is true. Because truth, it just is that matchup. This is called the correspondence view of truth. But you don't need to know the fancy terminology. It's what you mean when almost every single time you use the word truth to describe anything. Somebody says, hey, is the house is on fire. Really? Is that true? Well, is it on fire or not? You know, that's it. It's pretty straightforward. It's what we always mean when we make reference to truth in a day-to-day fashion. It's the garden variety definition of truth. And philosophers get a little fancy schmancy, and they could say, well, there's truth by correspondence, but there's also truth by coherence, and there's truth by pragmatic truth in different ways. But for practical purposes, those things don't matter because that isn't what we mean when we say, is there truth? If we're asking the question, what is truth? That would be Pilate's question. We might be asking, what does truth mean and can we know it? Or we might be asking, can we know the ultimate meaning of the universe? And I think that's what Pilate was after. Because he knew it was not true that Jesus was guilty of anything worthy of death, because the text says that. He knew that. The Jews had put him up because of jealousy. Those were facts. Those were things he knew to be the case. In other words, he had a belief that fit the world, so his belief was true. Okay? There are all kinds of facts that were involved in that deliberation, that enterprise. So when we ask the question, what is truth and can we know it? My first response is simply going to be that truths are statements of fact. Maybe that's another way to put it. And we understand fact to be a claim about the world that is so, that matches. So it's just, these are synonymous concepts. Now, can we know things like that? Of course. In fact, we do know things like that. And if we didn't know things like that, that is, if we couldn't figure out the facts of the world on some level, we would be dead in a day. Easy. Okay? And in fact, we have ways of testing and determining those things. I got Joseph from Washington, D.C. on the line. I got Sam from Missouri. I lost somebody that I wish I'd be able to talk to, but they had a belief that if they hit certain numbers in a certain order, that they would get a certain person on the phone, Amy Hall, and they would be put in the queue to talk with me eventually. And they hit those buttons, and guess who they got? In that order, they got Amy Hall. So they were able to test their belief against the real world. And when they tested their belief against the world, they discovered that their belief was true. It was an accurate belief. It was a fact. Okay? And that's just a very simple characterization of how this whole Project Truth works. And of course, there is truth. Truth is not, though many people say there is no truth, or truth is completely relative, it's up to the person who believes the things. That statement itself is meant to be a truth. Truth is relative. Really, is that true? There is no truth. Really, is that true? People make up truth. Oh, really, is that true? Or do you just make that up? See, you can't get out of this, all right? Because it's the way the reality is structured and the way knowledge works, all right? Now, there are some truths that you can know, and you can know them with a certainty, okay? And sometimes there are things that we think are true. We have beliefs that we think are true, and maybe they're strong hunches. That means the justification isn't really that good. We're not entirely certain. We may have confidence. We may not have certainty, though. Okay? So these are different for levels of confidence that the things that we hold to be the case are so. But those are examples of knowledge, not of truth. Okay? There can be statements that are true even if you don't know it. You know, you can get lucky. But knowledge is justified true belief. You have reasons for believing. Oh, you do. Can we have good reasons to believe things of an ultimate nature? Of course. Of course we can. When I ask about, you know, who banged the Big Bang, since virtually everybody believes the universe did not exist forever, it came into existence, what caused that to happen? It's either something or nothing. Okay, what's the odds on favorite? It ain't nothing. It's something. Something caused the rest of everything to come into existence. And that is not only just merely the odds on favorite, it is so self-evidently true as to be certain. Now, certain is a psychological quality, has to do with my attitude. People are certain about a number of things that aren't actually true, but they're certain about them. They're just simply mistaken. Okay. Since the question has to do with certainty, yeah, you can be certain about it, but you can also know it. That is, I think that things don't come from nothing is true, is self-evidently so. So I think it not just certain, but necessarily the case. This is one of the reasons I can't be an atheist, because their answer for where the universe came from, which is nowhere, from nothing, not even self-caused, because the self of the universe wasn't around to cause itself. I can't. That's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. And so I don't think it's true. In answer to the question, what is truth? Truth is correspondence. Facts. Okay. Is it knowable? Of course. If it wasn't, we wouldn't survive. Not a day. What about the big stuff, though? Ultimate truth. Well, I think the same kinds of tests can be applied to much more weighty concerns. The kinds of things that we talk about here on the program. Ethical concerns, religious concerns, details about God and about Jesus and stuff like that. Yes, we talk about it all the time. And what we do is we give reasons why we think that our beliefs are not just mere beliefs, but actually are examples of knowledge, things that we know to be so. And the reason we know them is because of the reasons that we have that support them. All right, so there are just to clarify terms. Let's take a quick break, and then I'll be to Joseph and then to Sam and whoever else calls in the meantime. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love #STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. #STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, #STRask. That's #STRask.
Hey friends, would you like to be encouraged throughout your week with timely, relevant content meant to bolster your knowledge, wisdom, and character? Or maybe you have a desire to be connected with other like-minded Christians from around the world? If so, then you need to follow Stand to Reason on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Not only will you be able to interact with other Stand to Reason followers, but you'll also stay up to date and informed on our latest resources and events. In our current culture, it's important to have something of value to break up your social media feed. So just visit str.org and find the links to all of our social media platforms at the bottom of the homepage.
The show is Stand to Reason. Greg Coatley, your host, after 32 years, still in the saddle. And our caller, the durable and patient Joseph in Washington, D.C. Joseph, you made it after, what, an hour and some change. Thank you for your patience.
Hey, Greg, long time no talk, man.
Say that again.
I said, long time no talk. I called back just before Christmas time.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Well, glad to have you on board again. Thank you. What's up?
No problem. I wanted to, it's actually kind of ironic. It's kind of a follow-up from Cade's question, kind of in relation, not just in relation to humans, but also in regards to just evolution and creationism, so to speak. I've come across quite a few atheists who are kind of a little bit dismissive of the argument for creationism, mostly because they appeal to evolution. I'm a biology graduate, studied under Marcus Ross at Liberty University, so I kind of developed a little bit of an understanding from the evolutionary perspective and the creationist perspective. So I think. I've got at least a well-educated opinion on this type of matter in regards to what I think is a good spot. But my question is, what kind of stance would you take in answering? What kind of hidden assumptions would you want to find first in an evolutionist proponent's questions? In order to get to the meat of the discussion and really try to articulate a good point for them.
Okay, so I think this is a good question, and there's some complexity in here in this issue too, because there's lots and lots of side rooms that people can go off of. But I'm actually going to be in Texas this weekend. In fact, I should have put that in the announcements, and I don't see them right in front of me, but I'm not a good host because I don't promote myself adequately, but no, I can't find it. But I'm going to be in Texas teaching at a conference this Saturday, and my opening talk is why I'm not an evolutionist. And what I have to do is I have to try to simplify the issue, be accurate to the issue, the definitions itself, and here the issue is not just change regarding time or even microevolution, but what's known as macroevolution or the neo-Darwinian synthesis. So these are terms I'm sure you're familiar with. The kind of the molecules to man hypothesis is that sound. And it sounds to me like what you've done is you've had some interaction with atheists who have been dismissive. I'm not sure. It sounded like you were saying they were dismissive of the cosmological argument I was making reference to, because they are committed Darwinists in the neo-Darwinian synthesis sense. Is that what you said?
It's kind of more in regards to opposing it from a scientific standpoint. They kind of phrase it more as a science versus faith type of mentality, which I'm sure most of the Christians who listen to your program are already aware that this is obviously a false dichotomy. It's definitely
yes,
but
that's
what would
true.
Be a good Yeah, okay, but what would be a good place to start from?
Let me. I have a couple things to say about this, and one of them is, you know, that Stephen Meyer. Did I interview Stephen already? I think I did. Yeah, I did. You can catch that interview. It's in the archives. His most recent book is The Return of the God Hypothesis. And part of what his argument is the science, and not just the science from his perspective, but the scientists in view of the science are leaning more and more towards a theistic worldview in many cases because the scientific evidence is so powerful for the organization, for the Big Bang. You know, Big Bang needs a Big Banger. That's the cosmological. But also when it comes to all the things that relate to Darwinian evolution, the information on the DNA double helix and all of the intricacies there, this is code, and code requires intelligence. It's not going to happen by accident. And more scientists are acknowledging that. So on the one hand, if a person is dismissive of the cosmological argument because they're going with science, well, science is supporting it more and more that the universe had an intelligent beginning. And more cosmologists and astrophysicists are saying exactly that. They have become theists because of the science, all right? So that's on one level. That's on this big, giant level of like the universe, all right? When it comes to the biological area, which is your concern, right? Your more precise concern.
Right. Definitely.
Okay, so but you're facing the same kind of thing. The reason that astrophysicists are becoming theists is because the evidence compels them to do that. That the evidence does not support a materialistic explanation for the origin of the universe. The same thing is happening in the biological realm, where the evidence does not support a materialistic origin of life or development of life from simple to complex. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, that is the Darwinian model. Or let me back up and put it this way. That is the materialistic model. To be more precise, right. Darwinism doesn't start until life is in place. But the project needs a kickoff. And that's why when I try to simplify it, I talk about two aspects. One is the kickoff, and the other one is the game, so to speak. The kickoff right. being the origin of life. And then the game being the development from simple to complex over time and by completely materialistic means. That's the model. Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
So if you divide it into two things like that, as the two pillars, okay, so to speak. Notice, by the way, both of them have to be clearly in place to affirm or assert that the materialistic Darwinistic model is in the running. All right. Both of them have to be demonstrably true. All right. Here's the difficulty, and you know this already. There is no clear sense of how anyone can account for living stuff coming from dead stuff, to put it most simply. Right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the origin of life issue. So I'm going to ask one of my questions is, okay, right at the very beginning, at the launch, at the kickoff, you have to have something happen that materialism is capable of producing. So how did that take place? This is my question. How did it take place? And the answer is, well, we don't know how, but we know it did. And then I ask, well, what makes you think that it did if you don't know how? Because these kinds of scientific questions are wrapped up in the how, right?
Right.
And definitely. How do you know that it did happen if you don't know how it happened? And the answer is always the same. They give the evolutionary creation story. They give a religious, jump leap of faith answer. I mean, I'm characterizing it this way on purpose. Because the answer is because materialism is true. Materialism says it, I believe it, that settles it. I mean, that really is the essence of their answer. Because they do not have, pardon the metaphor, the pun reference here, they don't have a prayer when it comes to the materialistic origin of life. There's no, I mean, and as time goes on, the worse it gets. And this is why it's been two decades now since they've been toying with the idea of directed panspermia, that life must have come from aliens from outer space. Why would a scientist say that when there's no evidence for aliens? Because they know that the life had to be intelligently designed. So I think that's the first step. That's the first question. You know, what is the evidence for that? All right. And there is no way. I mean, this, you can take this to the bank. So look, if you don't have a kickoff, you can't have a game. You don't have a game. If you don't have a kickoff, you don't have a game. They have to presume a materialistically impossible series of events, not just one. I mean, you've probably seen some of the math on the impossibility, not improbability. That's not a strong enough word. The impossibility of...
Yeah, I'm definitely well aware of that equation.
Say that again. Excuse me.
I said I'm very well aware of that equation. It's
okay. Yeah, and there's multiple,
like 40,000th power or something like that.
Yeah, I mean the numbers are unbelievable, and people like Stephen Meyer has done the math in his books. And you could also Doug Axe has done really good work and unbelievable, but really the numbers are so astronomical they can't even be countenanced. But you think of it this way: it's like putting a red dot on some subatomic particle. That would be like an electron or a neutron or something, you know. And in the entire universe, you have to find that one subatomic particle by chance. I mean, this is the probability of just one of these events. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of these radically impossible events that have to take place virtually simultaneously for life, even the simplest form of life, to be sustained, to come about or whatever. It just ain't going to happen. We know it's not going to happen. So this is a huge problem. And that is how do you get living stuff from dead stuff without intelligent intervention? And if they don't have an answer, then they have no right to claim that it did happen. Because the only basis for that claim is their own confidence in metaphysical materialism. Okay. But we have a similar...
Yeah, that makes sense, because when they claim to be coming from a scientific background, they're already claiming to have the explanation for all the events that are taking place. And if they can't have an explanation within the very method that they're using to explain that event, then it seems to me that they're just shooting themselves in the foot, so to speak.
Yeah,
and it's like pretty much a self-defeating argument from that point.
Right. Well, this is a good observation. And what they say is scientific, the scientific answer. And what they mean is not the methods of science, but the philosophy practiced by scientists. And that's materialism. Right. I remember having a discussion with an atheist during a Q&A at the University of Toronto, where I gave a talk many years ago. And he was at the microphone and he was asking about the origin of the universe. And I played out this series of events, you know, and making my case about essentially a big bang needs a big banger. And he says, his parting shot was, well, I'm going to go stick with the scientific answer, not the religious answer. And I said to him, but you haven't given any scientific answer. You haven't given any scientific characterization of how this could take place, which he hadn't. Right. And he walked away from the mic. Okay, but notice this is the move at this point. This is the move that they make, and the move is that we are going to just declare that our materialism is science. We're just going to declare it. And we dismiss your answers as religious, and we cling to ours as science, but this is where they're playing a shell game with the definition of the word science. So, but I do want to say something about this second area, excuse me, and that is this – we'll just call a transition from one to the other, from simple to more complex. And here, I mean, simple to more complex is the simplest way to put it. But when we say more complex, we're talking about from the simplest original life, wherever that came from, to the massive complexity of the biosphere. All right? And this is all has to be accomplished, according to classical Darwinism, in small steps, no saltations, no jumps, just small little individual steps which in themselves produce reproductive advantage for the living organism. And this is a very important point. Each little step is something that produces a reproductive advantage. It's not really survival of the species. That's a mischaracterization. You know this. It's the reproduction of the species. Amoebas don't survive very long at all. 10 minutes or right. whatever, you know. But boy, do they know how to reproduce. They mm-hmm. reproduce really fast. So the key here is the selfish gene, Dawkins' selfish genes, that can get it gets its genes into the next generation. That's what's really key. So the question is, how are these all of these little bitty changes that Darwinism is supposed to accomplish through mutation and then served by natural selection, how is that methodology, that motif going to accomplish right. this diversity? It can't do that. It just simply cannot do that. And we know that it can't do that.
I've asked a couple of my evolutionist colleagues, like, two basic questions in regards to the mechanism itself, which is, does genetic gain of information cause speciation, or is it a genetic loss of information that causes speciation?
Uh-huh.
And the other question is it what was the other one? It's off the top of my head.
Well, I would say the one that Stephen Meyer would say, where does the information come from in the first place? Because there is no materialistic way it can happen. Because what materialism can do is it's either chance or necessity. It's either total randomness, and that's not going to produce information, or it's necessity, that is law-like behavior that is going to of necessity result in this all this information on the DNA double helix. But neither right. of those things is capable of doing that. We have a uniform understanding in our experience of where information comes from. And information comes from minds, from agents, you know. And so this is the other element that's really critical here. So anyway, I think that evolutionists are facing insurmountable problems, and many of them are acknowledging this now, that the problems are insurmountable. They can't mm-hmm. deal with this in their materialistic mechanism. And so a lot of them are looking for some other kind of materialistic way than Darwinism. But Darwinism is the only game in town at the moment. And it's
right.
and since they can't go the other direction for some kind of intelligent design for philosophic reasons, they're going to cling to. They're going to go down with the Titanic, so to speak. They're going to polish the brass on the Titanic. That's what's going on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I just wanted to give like a brief commentary, and then I'll let you go, so that way you can answer some more of questions.
Yeah. Okay. Show. Good. Sure, and I appreciate the call, Joseph. So thanks for bringing the issue up. Okay, buddy?
Yeah, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome. Just to recap what we talked about, and this is the way I'm going to present it on Saturday in somewhere in Texas. You should probably look this up just to – okay, it's the Apologetic Evangelism Conference in Jacksonville, Texas. Okay. At the Jacksonville, Texas, at the Central Baptist Church there, okay? Central Baptist Church, it'll be all day. Actually, I start at 8:15 in the morning. That's early. And then we go all day long, so there's other speakers. But I'll be leading off with that issue. If anybody's within striking distance wants to go, that would be Central Baptist Church, Jacksonville, Texas. I think it's in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But in any event, but here's the way that I construe it. I try to simplify the issue, and that is, you've got to have a kickoff and you got to have a game. For the Darwinian model, you've got to have a launch. That means you've got to get living stuff from dead stuff. That's impossible. And by the way, if you don't demonstrate that that actually took place within reason, then you can't say that the game proceeded from there. But the game is another problem. How do you? What makes you think? What makes anyone think that there is a excuse me that a materialistic mechanism like natural selection working on mutations can produce the kind of variety that we have. There's a couple of problems with that, by the way, not just the mechanism proper doing the job, but when you look at the fossil record, you actually see these explosions of development, or maybe development is the right word here, of novel features like the Cambrian explosion and the Burgess Shale that demonstrates all these unbelievably complex phylum of living organisms that have no prior evolutionary history in the record. And the complexity of all of these critters would require on the evolutionary assessment a long history that should be evidenced in some fashion, it seems, in the fossil record, but it's not. Everything explodes onto the scene, and there's multiple explosions in the history of the development of life. So these are counterintuitive to a Darwinian model. So these are other problems here. And then there's the natural selection working in mutations. That's the neo-Darwinian synthesis. Well, where did the information come from to begin with that gets mutated to produce a new physical form? And that's one of the big projects of Stephen Meyer in his first big book, which was titled Signature in the Cell. Then his second one, which was a New York Times bestseller, Darwin's Doubt. And there he looks at, the Cambrian explosion. And then his more recent one, which I recommend them all, but the Return of the God Hypothesis. It's returning because this is the way everybody believed it actually took place, because that's what made the most sense given all the evidence. And then a new philosophy, a materialistic philosophy, kind of finds its way into the conversation. People are convinced of this. And Darwin then gives what appears to be, at least at first blush, a justifiable scientific rationale for how this could actually take place with no intelligent design. But as time has marched on, we've found that this does not work. It just doesn't. And some other option is required to explain the complexity of life on Earth. And the one that makes the most sense of the evidence is some form of intelligent design. Okay, let's go to break and be back with Sam in Missouri when we return on Stand to Reason.
Do you know that killing an unborn human being is against the law in most states? The only exception is when the mother wants her child dead and asks a doctor to kill it. Then it's legal. It's protected. It's funded by our tax dollars. And today, the freedom to choose is even celebrated. We live in a world where a woman decides whether another innocent and defenseless human being lives or dies. But is it that simple? Don't women have a right to control their own bodies? Can't many poor women not afford to have another baby? Should a woman who was raped be forced to carry the criminal's baby? It's complicated. It's chaos. But there's a solution. There's a way to make sense of the confusion. We need to anchor our thinking about abortion to reality. Then we'll see how we can help both unborn human beings as well as their born mothers who face a difficult decision. Join us for this year's Reality Conference, where we'll see how the solution to abortion will bring clarity to the chaos. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
Do you want to become a more knowledgeable Christian ambassador without sitting through a formal course on apologetics? Well, we've made that possible for you through our STR Quick Reference app. Available for free on iTunes and Google Play, the STR Quick Reference app holds a wealth of information summarizing what you need to know on a range of topics. Learn how to defend the faith, see how other worldviews compare to Christianity, and master the biblical view of morality, all through short, engaging videos. Before you know it, you'll be well-versed on a number of important apologetics topics. In addition, the Quick Reference app also includes a Bible with text and audio, as well as some featured STR resources, all to enhance your learning experience. The STR Quick Reference app will equip you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the key issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Visit iTunes or the Google Play Store today and download the STR Quick Reference app. And if you enjoy the app, make sure you give it a 5-star review.
Thank you.
for Sam in Missouri. I see an hour and 17 minutes and 57 seconds here, Sam. You're a champion.
Hey, Greg, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, thanks.
So my question actually has to go along with what you were talking about at the start of the show with truth. And my professor put out some reading materials, and as I was reading, I came across these few sentences on truth, and I wanted
okay.
to read it to you and
sure.
hear how you would respond.
All right.
So it begins, many people think truth means what I believe, but if that were the case, it would be a useless concept subject to whim, tradition, and force. Truth, like length, is abstract. An example, it exists only as an idea, as opposed to something concrete that exists as matter or energy. It is a measurement of the accuracy of descriptive statements. So
what was the last phrase? Wait, it's a measurement of the accuracy of descriptive statements?
Yes.
Okay, good. I got it. Okay, is that
and
it?
And that's where it ends, yes.
Okay, well, I agree entirely with what he said. This is, truth is a measurement of descriptive statements. In measuring whether they are so or not, or actually what, actually truth isn't a, I guess I could pick up the words a little bit here. Truth is not a measurement of descriptive statements. It is a, I'm looking for just the right word here, and maybe it won't come to me. But I guess I could live with measurement. But what it is, it's an assessment. That something is true is an assessment of a descriptive statement, all right? And when we say it's not true, it's also an assessment to the negative, all right? But here's the concern I have a little bit, is I'm not sure the point that he's trying to make. Because what I did is I offered the definition of truth a little bit earlier, and I talked around that issue quite a bit, and then I showed how that functions for us in the world. It serves to help identify facts about the world, even facts about the physical world. So there can be truths about the physical world and truths about the non-physical world. But as I characterize truth, and even as he's doing it as measurement or assessment of descriptive statements, then the status, the ontological status, the nature of the existence of truth is an abstract. It is not a concrete. If what concrete means is something physical, it can be truth abstract. Accurate claims about physical things. It could be abstract claims about non-physical things. I mean, you could have abstract truth claims about abstracts, and they could still be true. And that's why I'm a little mystified by this. This seems to be a kind of dismissal when he says, well, what people say truth is what I believe. Well, if you know who says that? Relativists say that. That's the whole gender thing. What is the truth of your gender? Whatever I believe. I'm not sure if this professor was meaning to take that on when he made this point, but he is essentially denying that truth is relativistic, that it simply is a matter of what your beliefs are. It sounds to me that's what he's trying to say. He's trying to zero in on it, but I'm not sure if he's trying to, if he thinks he's dismissing non-physical or claims about non-physical realities as being true. Because is he saying that only concrete things can be real? And truth, that's just an abstract and it's not concrete, it's not physical. I'm not exactly sure what he's trying to accomplish here. But so far, what you've read, I've agreed with it all.
Yeah. The part where I get confused at is when he gives the example that truth exists purely as an idea. It's not like matter or energy where we see it physically or we can see the use of it in a physical sense.
Sure.
It only exists as an idea.
Well, when you say when he says only as an idea, I'm not sure why that's helpful. It does exist as an idea. Therefore, it is an existent. It is something that does exist. Now, the nature of truth is that it's non-physical, though it's referring to physical things. The beliefs are not physical. Beliefs are abstract in some sense. Now, they are about things that might be physical, but a belief is a mental attitude in which you hold something to be so. That's what a belief is. Well, that's not physical. That's not concrete. All right? It's so what? I don't know what that gets anybody. All right. If he's trying to suggest that there are two levels of reality, there are concrete, real things, and then other things that aren't so real. They are kind of abstract, and they're only ideas, so they're not quite real. Well, realness is not a degreed property. It isn't you get like 50% of realness or 75% of realness. It's like pregnancy. You're either pregnant or not. You know, it's 100% one or the other. So again, I don't know what he's trying to accomplish by characterizing truth as an idea. I mean, ideas are real. The idea guy was Plato, and he never doubted the reality of the forms. Those were real, but they were not physical. In fact, his sense, I'm not a Plato guy, but my understanding is that he thought the forms were the most, that was where reality was grounded. Okay, what we see is not, it's just a, these are the shadows. This is the shadow lands we live in. And they are not things as they are in themselves, but the Platonic forms was where reality was. So I don't know how. I don't have any difficulty, Sam, with his. In what you've characterized so far of his view, I don't have any difficulty with it. And if he said, "Yeah, well, it's just an idea." Well, it is an idea, but I don't know what the just does for you. So what? Okay, truth is an idea. Beliefs are abstracts. They're non-physical realities. The world is filled, it's populated, the immaterial world, with all kinds of things that are not physical. And we have access to them. Math is not physical. You could say math is just an idea if you want to, but it's not physical, but it certainly manifests itself, overlays the physical universe. The universe, physical universe, responds in a certain way to the reality of the immaterial math that stands behind it. And I'm still mystified by what your professor thinks he gets from this. Am I missing something?
Yeah, that's where I'm a little confused too, because I've just been trying to think it over, but it seems like he categorizes two different kinds of truths, but he's not using truth to relate to, like, we know matter exists. It seems like he's distinguishing between, like, E equals MC squared is true objectively, but when it seems like he's defining truth as our subjective ideas that we come up with, our worldview, what encompasses our ideas, as opposed to gravity, you know, accelerates objects down to the earth. We have equations that we can predict certain times and events of the cosmos.
Well, you know what? What might be lurking in the shadows here is a kind of verificationism. Now, this may be a fancy two-bit word. I get to use them because I spent a lot of money to get my master's degree in philosophy, so verificationism. But this was the idea that a claim was not meaningful. It was not even meaningful if it could not be verified through the scientific method or something like that. So to say God exists isn't false. It's meaningless on the verificationist view. Okay? The problem with verificationism, and this seems to be what he's talking about. Well, I can verify gravity. I can verify equally E equal MC squared. But, of course, what's really curious about that is that's all math. And math ain't physical, right? But and math doesn't respond to the scientific method. The scientific method requires math to work. So math precedes the scientific method. But nevertheless, it sounds like what he's simply saying is all of your beliefs about these immaterial things cannot be verified scientifically, and therefore they can't be called truths. All right? Now, the reason it's kind of a chuckle is there are very few verificationists anymore. And the reason is verificationism does not satisfy its own requirement. So the claim that truth right. is only truth and meaningful if it can be scientifically verified itself cannot be scientifically verified.
Yeah, exactly.
And not only that, there does seem to be a whole bunch of things that are true that we know that aren't scientifically verifiable, even in principle. So, I mean, my awareness that I exist is not something that you can scientifically assess. You can't assess my awareness. My awareness of the world is first person private. All right. And that's why if you want to know what I'm thinking, you have to ask me. Okay. But I know what I'm thinking and I know that my thoughts are true. I mean, let me back up. I know that my thoughts about what I'm thinking are true thoughts, okay? That is, I can't be mistaken yeah. about what I'm thinking. Oh, I think I was thinking about pizza for dinner tonight, but maybe I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about something else. No, your own thoughts, you have incorrigible access to your own thoughts. Let's put it that way. But no one else has access like that. But these are not physical things. Science isn't. You're not going to clamp this machine in my head and, okay, here's what he's thinking. Kind of thing. So even to know that certain parts of your brain, when they light up, you know, for the machine, when they're active, represent or seem to correspond with certain mental states, like thinking about food or thinking about sex or thinking about religion or something like that. Well, the only way they know that is by the subject reporting it. It's the guy on the inside. It's got to tell what's going on the inside that corresponds with what the scientists see on the outside. So anyway, it seems so obvious to me, Sam, that we live in a world that is both matter in which you have material things and immaterial things, and we are directly in contact with each of those all the time, except for when we're unconscious, I guess, and then we might be dreaming. But and these things are obvious. Say again?
That's very interesting. During our lecture today, he actually quoted Descartes, "Therefore, I think, therefore I am."
Uh-huh.
And it coincides with what you said of, well, I'm thinking, therefore I'm existing. But it seems like if he's taking a verificationist approach, you can't sort of affirm Descartes' quote with the scientific method, because it's more subjective of I know I am because I know I am.
That's right. Yeah. And by the way, subjective only in the sense that the information only in the sense that the subject is the one who has access to this information. It is not subjective in the sense that it's true because some subject believes it. In this particular case, an individual's awareness of his own existence, of his thinking, is proof of his existence. And this is obviously true. Yeah, I mean, who needs to do a scientific experiment to know that that's legitimate? There it is. I mean, it's no duh. I think, therefore I am. Or I actually had a T-shirt once I saw in northern Wisconsin said, I fish, therefore I am. But you get the point. All right. So if he brought that up in class today, Descartes tried to build a whole system of knowledge of certainty based on what can I be, what is something that I couldn't be mistaken about? And that's where he starts, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. But, you know, that's pretty obvious. Now, building more on that, that's another project. And a lot of people think he ultimately failed in the broader project. But the starting point, how can that be taken exception with, right? It's just obviously so. So, the thinking, by the way, the thinking is not concrete if concrete means material. It's abstract if abstract means immaterial. That's what thoughts are. Thoughts aren't C fibers firing in your brain. That might be going on while I'm thinking, but that's not what a thought is. A thought has different qualities than the physical things that are going on in your brain. So I don't know, this would be interesting. I'd be really like to talk with you again, Sam, about this, you know, whenever you want to call, as more things come up in the class and you get a clearer idea of what this professor's project is and where he goes with it. I'd love to hear from you again.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely call back if there's any more addition.
Okay, sounds good. Hey, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, we'll talk to you next time. Oops, sorry. Didn't let her say goodbye. Sorry about that, Sam. But there it is. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. There are physical things and non-physical things in the world. And we, like I said, we encounter them all the time. And this is what is ordinary people believe this because it's so. Sometimes you got to have a PhD in order to deny the obvious, though I'm not sure that's what this professor was doing. Anyway, I do agree with what he'd said, properly qualified. All right, that's it for this hour, friends. Thanks for being part of the show. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven, okay? Bye-bye.